Cool. Welcome back to another episode of Work in Programming. This week, I'm joined by Samir Mehta. Samir, do you want to quickly introduce yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Samir. Most people call me Sam. Right now, I'm a developer support engineer. Before that, I've been doing a bunch of full stack roles at startups at Toronto. And before that, I was in school. So very early on in my career still. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's me. It's been about two, I feel like it's been 3 years, but you know, time just flies by when you're having fun since I graduated.
Yeah, totally. And during the middle of a pandemic, I guess.
Yep, of course.
Cool. And you studied computer science, right?
Yeah, I studied computer science at Ryerson, downtown Toronto. Mm-hmm.
And did you do like a co-op while you were in school, or did you just jump right into the workforce after school, or how did that all play out?
Yeah, funny thing about that. So my GPA was horrible in first and second year. So I didn't get into the co-op program because there's a GPA requirement after the first year. But I lucked out eventually. So first, I lucked out in getting I believe it was called a work-study program or something that we had at Ryerson, where you can study along with getting a job at the university in one of the departments. Mm-hmm. I ended up as a IT assistant at the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Office. It's been renamed, I think, now. And then after that, looked into a job at a startup with one of my friends from the program doing PHP work, which was fun because PHP is a horrible language. But that experience really, it was great because it was very early days in that startup. So I was the second guy there. It was just me and my friend programming, building out essentially a low-code software for pharmacies. We had big clients overseas in Qatar. So it was quite a lot of fun, lots to learn there because we were the only two there programming. So we got to do a lot of cool things there. Took that experience, landed my first job out of school, and then I was on my way.
Cool. And when you were building that low-code tool, How did that come to be? Because I imagine if you're working with pharmacies, that would be like a pretty, I would assume that you'd need some like background knowledge in the industry to kind of understand the problem space there or.
Yeah. So it wasn't directly dealing with any sorts of things that have like regulations, like, you know, drugs or anything like that. It was doing things like inventory management and building out systems for their employees to do time tracking. So it was just building out low-code tools for the pharmacies to be enabled so that they can sort of customize it and, you know, do sorts of like customizations to tailor it to their own custom needs.
Okay, very cool. And then your first job out of school, was that with DealTap?
Yeah, that was with DealTap. That was a company based in Etobicoke, right near Kipling Station. So we were building a, I guess you could call it a smart contract platform. It wasn't really a contract in the smart contracts in the Ethereum Web3 sort of sense. It was in the real estate space. So when you're buying a house or renting, you know, there's like a lot of paperwork, such a hassle there because you have to go back and forth between offers, you know, or change something out if there's, you know, certain things. So you go through a inspection and there's something missing, you know, something has to be changed on the paper, so on and so forth. And there's a lot of legal requirements around archiving data, how it can be signed, because there's e-signing regulations in Canada. So we were building essentially e-signing tool as well as a contracts platform. So the customers of the real estate agents could sign online and then the contracts could be sent from the agent to the company that they work for, the brokerage, and the agent would get paid. Smooth process for everyone. Everyone's happy at the end of the day. Because with a lot of the existing tools like DocuSign, they're a bit inconsistent in terms of their product. So even in separate views in the same product, so it's not like you're on mobile versus desktop. It's like you're in the view mode versus the edit mode. This text will be slightly shifted or there'll be something off. So with real estate having such regulations around, you know, so you can't really white out anything in real estate contracts, right? Because kind of have to have that copy. So you have to scratch it out right on top, not exactly on top of the text, but like a little bit higher, and then make another copy and resign. And there's a whole lot of paperwork. So those are restrictions around it. So with existing tools like DocuSign, it wasn't really the best fit. So we were kind of building that platform out. It was a great experience too, because we were doing a rewrite essentially, because there was an existing version they had already out on the market, which was a custom JS framework on the front end side and PHP on the back end side. But that had run into like certain scaling issues, and because they were doing a lot of complex linking of documents. Like if you input data into one form, it has to link across to all documents. So it was computationally heavy. So we were doing a rewrite in React and Golang. React, because, you know, it's kind of like the industry standard nowadays. Everyone just, if they learn JS, the next thing they learn, it seems, is now React, and hopefully soon Next, because I'm really a Next fanboy now.
Totally. Yeah. No, I think Next has done a lot for the standardization. And then when you were working on the, so you said Golang in the background, were you working on the back end as well?
Yeah. I was full stack. I actually started out on the back end side when we were really starting out, because when I just got hired, we were really just prototyping, okay, should we use this database? Should we go with this technology? So I started out on the back end side building GraphQL endpoints and resolvers. So we had initially gone with a dgraph, which is a graph database written in Golang. It's a really cool technology to work with and super fun too, because you just get your data like instantly, essentially. It's like, oh, I need this sort of data. Whereas you would in SQL, you kind of have to do the like complex joins to get certain data. It's like, oh, it's like one traversal way.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then started doing a lot more work on the front end side, building out, you know, our authentication on the front end side, our sorts of like teams essentially on the platform, so you could belong to a certain brokerage and that sort of system, and a lot more on the PDF editor. That was a big undertaking.
That sounds like it would be a bit of a nightmare. I've heard that PDFs are like very inconsistent across the board.
Yeah. They are. They're a bit tricky to work with. What we ended up doing was we used, I believe, Mozilla's PDFJS library or one of the open source libraries, and then we built on top of it. So it was pretty solid, and we did a lot of like testing. I actually led a bit of the testing there. So I did investigation into like, should we use tools like what's that really popular one? Selenium or Cypress. Cypress wasn't really going to work for us, because Cypress is was Chrome only. I think it still is. I think they were investigating like using others.
Interesting. And then so what did you end up? Did you end up using anything for the end-to-end test, or you just didn't bother at the end, I guess?
Yeah, we used Test Cafe, which is another tool, and I really liked it. It was very similar to Cypress in the sense that you can write your tests in JavaScript, and it's super easy to get going with a lot of utilities and whatnot there. But it's also, you can script it such that you can open it in Firefox, Chrome, mobile versions of those browsers, and then you can Dockerize it and so on. It was a really good solution for us, because we had to make sure that, you know, if you cross something out using our like cross out tool in one browser, it renders the exact same way in a different browser on a different platform, Windows, Mac, whatever, right?
That makes sense. Like that sounds a lot of, cause yeah, I guess like from what I don't really know a whole lot about the real estate industry, but like my understanding is like they tend to use, at least lawyers a lot, like tend to use Word because they can like redline stuff, I guess, and they can save revisions.
Yeah, totally.
So I guess in the end, like you kind of have to like rebuild a lot of that in PDFs, I guess.
Yep.
Sounds like.
We had to essentially rebuild like text boxes and checkboxes, because the text boxes have to conform to certain restrictions too, right? Like the overflow has to render exactly the same in certain browsers and all of that. And it also had to be performant too, right? Because the previous version, the 3.0 version of the product that was already on the market, the PHP one, didn't have a PDF editor built in. And we were building this from the ground up for this version of the product. And so we wanted it to be extremely performant, not like DocuSign or anything like existing solutions out there. So I believe we did some testing. It was like we could have like 1,000 fields per page and like 100 plus fields. We capped it at like 100 pages per PDF, but you could have like 10 PDFs at the same time all editing in like one go, and you could drag all those without like much noticeable like really no leg if you had a decent machine. But yeah,
interesting.
Pretty fun.
And were you like to do that? Like, are you like loading the PDFs into memory, and like how do you manage all that without overloading I imagine that would just like bog down Chrome so much.
Oh yeah, totally. If you load all of them at once, totally. So what we did was we would load whatever's in the view. So lazy loading everything. Like you could, anything you could think of that doesn't need to be loaded right away, lazy load, don't even worry about it. And with the fields, we did a lot of like work to make them performant to move. And it was a lot of like heavy calculations we did to figure out like, okay, the distance from here to here is going to be this much. How do you make it move such that it looks fast enough, right? And I don't exactly remember now because it's been like 2 years what exactly we did, but it was a lot of work.
That sounds pretty exciting for like a first role out of school. Like it sounds like you got to dig in and like learn quite a bit, which I imagine was useful going forward.
Yeah, definitely. Going forward after that job, I ended up at CareGuide where I met one of our mutual friends, Tom. CareGuide, I was also doing full stack. The stack there is Ruby, and I believe it was when I started, it was React, but with Ruby on Rails. So the React was like a gem. And we had like performance issues as well with the React gem. It was essentially a node server that would spring up every time you wanted it to render anything. It was also server-side rendering. But the data, like the props, would be sent by the Ruby backend from a HAML template into the JS. And then in between that sort of node server and the backend, there was like a huge memory leak problem that we had going. I believe first month or second month, I brought down prod like 2 times. Which was fun.
That sounds pretty exciting. Yeah, I have never worked with Ruby with React, but I remember like a lot of my friends would like, they were working on Ruby applications, and so they hadn't touched React or any like newer frameworks because from what I understood, like it wasn't like really feasible to like work with it. Did you guys stay with Ruby and like keep everything the same and just like improve? Like, how did you go about improving the React side of things?
So when I started out, especially with that prod issue, I actually learned that a lot of the old front end things that they had. So they had in some places they had Apollo. There's some places they had Relay for the GraphQL bits. Some places they had just Axios. So there's a lot of like conflicting practices and a lot of like, you know what they say about like having too many cooks in the kitchen. There was a lot of like dead code, bad code practices. So when I was getting started, I was just like, okay, let's just make it work. So initially for that issue that came up, I ended up learning that one of the libraries was completely useless that I had to use. So I ended up working around that with Apollo. But then what Tom was actually doing at the same time was actually starting a Next.js front end, which is kind of why I'm a Next.js fanboy now. And he was starting the rebuild process of like our home pages. So CareGuide has, I believe, 26 or 28 different websites that all run from, most of them run from the same core platform, which Tom and I were on the team for. And these platforms are like, it's a two-sided marketplace for anything for care, right? So say you need a nanny or a elder care provider for your elderly parents or something like that, right? So Tom was starting off working on this new front end for us, redoing all the home pages and just getting that set up. So I started migrating over to that, helping out a lot more with that, because trying to improve the old backend front end thing just wasn't going to be viable. So the backend also had these like code issues, like the tech debt, right? Because there had been so many people that had come and gone, and there's just been so many different practices, because the code base was like 8 years at least, right? And the Ruby on Rails version was super old too. So anytime you try to update anything, like I tried to update the React version, it would break the entire site. Like there would be some part that would be broken, and trying to figure out why was just a mess, because there's like weird practices and no one really knew what like was going on. So there was a lot of like those tech debt issues. So we decided, okay, just, you know, completely new from scratch. And with Next.js, like the delivery speed of features just went through the roof, right? Because it was just all new stack. And we could just follow the best practices, right? And there'd just be one way of working, not like, okay, let's do Relay here. Let's do Apollo client here. Let's do Axios here. Let's do this. Let's do that, right? And that consistency just like improved our delivery speed a lot. And then at the same time, there was like a backend refactoring, paying down that tech debt as well.
I'm just curious. So you have this Next.js application, you have to fetch data into it somehow. Were these like new, I'm assuming that these were like, you're rebuilding existing sites, like some of the existing care guide websites. So if you're doing that, you're probably still hitting the same data sources. So are you like recreating endpoints, or how does fetching the data change from, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So with the old front end, so since there had been different like technologies being used at the same time, right? So relay on like one page, poll another, that was the inconsistency. Whereas with the Next.js front end, we decided, okay, Apollo all the way, right? Because that's what we're comfortable with. We know how to work with it. We have that knowledge. And the existing endpoints already were there. But as we built it, right, as we rebuilt it, we realized, okay, some of the data that's coming from these GraphQL endpoints is also inconsistent with what's already on our current website. Like, so we had to go back and fix the old backend endpoints. So it was a lot of like, on my side, it was all just front-end work really with Next.js. But on the back end side, there had to be those improvements made as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Cause I guess like at the end of the day, like you're not completely rebuilding everything. You're just moving everything over. It's cool that you had those GraphQL endpoints and were able to switch over. Like it seems like maybe there was a lot of different people working on it, but it was still well built enough that it was like fairly flexible despite using a multitude of different tech.
Yeah. For the GraphQL side on the backend, thankfully they stuck to one library, which was, I believe, GraphQL Ruby or some Ruby GraphQL library. I forget the name of now. But it was the backend side, in terms of the responses and the tech for the GraphQL bits was very solid. So we didn't have that many issues, but you know, there was still some inconsistencies and whatnot. So fixed those. And then eventually we started building out more of the site. So not just the home pages, now we're working on, say, the login pages, the directory pages, which were a big thing for us. The directory pages is sort of like the, I guess, like if you're browsing like Kijiji or something, you know how there's those listings of products? Yeah, so essentially that, we rebuilt that. And then even then we learned like, oh, certain websites have this flag somewhere in the code that only enables this exact feature for that website. So we had to build like weird things that were already in the backend code base. So we had to go clean those up and rebuild that. So that was a lot of fun because in the way that like the first job was a lot of building from scratch. This was building from scratch, but also refactoring. So you kind of get that experience of like working with a mature tech stack.
That makes a lot of, that's really cool. And then, yeah, so I guess, which did you prefer? Did you prefer to work with the net new or do you prefer to work with existing systems?
I think completely from scratch is just a lot more fun, you know? You kind of get to make all the decisions. Even with the, like the Next.js front end, me and Tom essentially just made the decisions. Okay, we're going to do things this way. Tom initially in the start because he's like, okay, I'm going to go with styled component, styled system, and we're going to have this consistency. And then I added on like, okay, we want to start doing tests this way and sort of follow this paradigm. And sort of just getting to choose what you want to do is just so liberating because you don't have to like deal with somebody else's like garbage that they left behind for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think what I like is that you're saying that you like to be able to build fresh, but you're actually referring to the site where you did have some constraints. There was some existing infrastructure there that you had to rely on, but it's still like, it's like an optimistic view of taking over a brownfield project where it's like, you can still do your new stuff on top of it. You don't have to, you're still given the freedom to like rebuild things, even though it's an existing app, which is, it sounds, I like that outlook.
Yeah, totally. I mean, even for, even when we had rebuilt out the home pages and the directory pages for most of our sites or all of our sites, we still had the rest of the application. So like the messaging system was still on the old front end because we had like Kubernetes doing the routing to like certain parts of the website to the old front end. So if we needed to add features to that, I would still need to go into the back end code and be like, okay, well, not really back end, but it was like front end on back end and deal with the mess there. But it was a good experience in the sense that you kind of get to learn with that, like, here's what's been tried and true and here's what didn't work. And here's how you can like, you know, new tech comes out like every day and there's this like hype cycle. But there's like some things that like have consistent consistently work, like certain design patterns, MVC works, right? You know, learning from that experience is like really helpful because you don't want to fall for all these like newfangled technologies that come out one day and then next day they're kind of dead.
Totally, yeah. Like if you rebuild the whole thing on, not to shit on Gatsby, but if you rebuild the whole thing in Gatsby, then you don't know if necessarily like it'll be around forever. No, that's a bad example. I'm going to just not say that. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I guess Ember, right? Ember was a hot technology, but now it feels like it's kind of dead, right? When I was in school, like, true. Ember was so hot. Ember, Meteor were like the big things, and then React came out, and now it feels like React is like now the standard, and it might just stay that way for like next maybe 3-5 years, who knows. I don't want to make any bold predictions though, because they keep on adding new things and I'm like, do we really need this?
Do we really need to break everything for concurrent mode? Yeah, I don't know. React is definitely one of those frameworks. It's interesting because at the time it was like the hype new thing, you know? Like I remember I got started on AngularJS for web, and I was resistant to go over to React because, you know, it was a lot of new stuff. And then I don't know, like switching over, it seemed unnecessary. And then, you know, lo and behold, like Angular managed to kill itself in about like 2-3 years after.
Yeah.
I mean, like that year, but yeah. I like that you chose Ember as the example, because I feel like I still like hear about Ember applications like in production. Like it's super mature, but it's still well used, right? It's still stable, so people still use it. But I don't hear many people talking about like Meteor anymore, even though it's still around kicking. I think the team switched over to like Apollo, like building Apollo for the most part. But
yeah, so Meteor, I heard, got bought out by, I believe, Tiny Capital, which runs like Designer News and a bunch of like, they're on WeWork remotely, I think. A lot of like cool sites on the web. And they're all, I think, based out of Victoria, BC. So they're a cool company.
Yeah.
They're now running Meteor on the hosted platform for Meteor app. So Galaxy. It's still ongoing. Yeah, Galaxy.
That is so cool. I didn't know about that.
Most of this team switched over to Apollo as well. So yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, that is so cool. Yeah, Tiny owns, they just like buy these like small, really well sustainable companies, and like they're pretty cool. I think they own Dribbble.
Yeah, Dribbble is a big one.
I interviewed Jesse Hurlitz, who he took over Castro after they bought Castro as well.
Yeah,
like I love it. Like they own so many small little, like so many cool little companies.
Honestly, I can't wait for Castro to come on to Android, because like from the looks of that app, it's like, because I listen to a lot of podcasts, and just managing with Google Podcasts experience isn't great. Spotify, I don't like having my music and my podcast in one app. You know, mm-hmm. So like Casto seems like a good thing, because a certain podcast, they only have like a few different episodes that are good. I don't want to subscribe to the whole thing and get notifications about like the stuff I'm not interested in, right? Whereas Casto seems like it's episode by episode, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, like they maintain like one queue, which is cool, because then you can get like an organized feed of all your episodes coming in, and you don't have to worry about like losing track of what you were actually interested in because there's a bunch of new updates. I like Spotify recently came out with you can now, like, it seems so simple and so obvious, but you can now queue up podcast episodes separately from your music, and it actually makes it like viable to use. But it's still, yeah, there's still a lot missing. I've been trying out Breaker. I wouldn't recommend it. It's like, given how much funding they have, I have no idea why the app is so broken. Like it will just crash randomly. I've tried a few, and so far I haven't found a good one for Android. There's so many like really good ones for iOS though. Castro is one, and then there's this new Air app, which is good for like note-taking and stuff in your episodes. And I hear it's a pretty good listening experience as well.
Neat, yeah. What I like to do is like, if I find a really good episode that I like, I'll keep the file. Like I'll keep the episode in Google Podcasts and not delete after I'm done listening to it, and then go back, have my computer open, listen to it, and like open up Notion, take notes simultaneously, which is like, the next time you go back and listen to it, you kind of get the, you already know what's happened, what's been talked about, but you kind of hear the subtext too. You kind of learn a bit more, which is pretty cool.
That's really interesting. That's cool. Actually, you posted something about this on one of my LinkedIn posts, but you mentioned Zettelkasten before. Do you do a lot of like note taking?
Yeah. I've really been trying to get into that this year. I started around, I want to say March-ish, in getting into Zettelkasten. So I found this YouTube video, or I'm not sure where I exactly heard about it first. I think it was like a Hacker News article or something about the guy who created it and how he was so organized and wrote all these papers. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. Like, if I can learn this, I can actually read the books that I like to read, like the nonfiction, Indistractable and all these like sort of productivity books, and actually keep that knowledge and not have to go back and forth and re-listen to it. Because I've listened to like Deep Work by Cal Newport at least 4 times. Right.
Yeah.
And then every year or every now and then I go back and listen to it because I'm like, probably forgot how to like actually do deep work properly. Let me go listen to that. But now I have this system which I just like search in there. I'm like, okay, I want to know, how should I structure my resume? How should I do this? How should I do that? Right. I just have all the notes in there and it's all like properly structured, which is pretty genius. The person that thought of it, like really cool.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And yeah, like he used it to like, write, I think it was like hundreds of books or something like that. It's cool. And so do you keep all of this in Notion?
Yeah, I try to keep it in Notion. I've tried other apps, Obsidian. I haven't never tried Realm Research, but I've heard that's really good for Zettelkasten and these sorts of like knowledge capture things as well.
Mm-hmm.
But for like quick notes, it's like Apple Notes or Google Keep. Like I'll jot down an idea and then I'll transfer it into Notion. But like I find Notion just works for me. From the outside, it looks like a product that's very confusing because it's like, oh, it can do calendar, it can do your, you know, Trello sort of thing, can do your journal, like Evernote sort of books and OneNote sort of style of note taking. But you can really customize it to what you want. So if you put in like the, I don't know, 20 minutes it's going to take you to like customize a process to what you already follow on like a piece of paper or whatever other system you have. It's really great. Like it has all the features that you need. Like you can upload files in there, screenshots, everything. It's really a good product.
I'm curious. So how do you structure it? So I use Notion for my podcast and YouTube videos and blog articles. And I just have like a Kanban board that I use to track the status of each episode or whatever thing I'm producing. And then I have like one thing that I took it off of Ali Abdaal's video about resonance calendar. So it's basically just a place I dump stuff I read on the internet. And then I'll go back and take notes and like link it to different sources or whatever. But if you're taking these like detailed notes, how do you structure your, like, how do you structure that? Like, do you put it into a database? Is it just like a list? Is it just one giant note?
Yeah. So what I do usually, if I find some interesting article or interesting YouTube video, is I'll watch a little bit of it or I'll read a little bit of it just to get an idea of what it's talking about and just like to see if it's actually interesting or if it's just, you know, because there's so much like, especially on Medium, there's just so much like clickbaity stuff that's out there. It's like it's really not worth my time reading the whole article. But if it is, what I'll do is I'll bookmark it. I have too many bookmarks. I really need to trim down on that, like Marie Kondo the whole thing. But I'll bookmark it, and then at the end of the day, what I'll do is I'll go into my bookmarks and find an article that I thought was interesting or a YouTube video that I bookmarked. And then what I have is I have a database in my Zettelkasten that's sort of a reference box. So I keep like the where I found it, what tags it's sort of related to. So is it talking about like career-related stuff like resumes or whatever? Or is it talking about learning, how to like best learn, freelancing, whatever else, right? Startup ideas, this and that. And then I just kind of keep the metadata information of that in there. It's like a book website, YouTube video, what's the link to it? And then I'll go into my Zettelkasten. I'll have like an index note, which is, it's kind of following that same, mostly the same procedure that the person that created Zettelkasten, I forget their name now, Ludwig, I think something, irrelevant. Yeah, Lumen. Yeah.
Lumen. I've got the article open. Nicholas Lumen.
Nicholas.
I don't know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, but what I'll do is I'll create like an index note just as a brief like little thing about like why I think this article or video is even important to watch or read, like what am I going to gain from this? And then I'll go in and create my individual notes. So I'll have like, if I read a chapter of books, so I'm right now reading James Clear's Atomic Habits, right? I'll like read a chapter or I'll read a little bit. And then if something strikes me as like very interesting or something that's like deep or insightful, I'll note that down in a note. And then if there's something that follows from that, or if there's something that's proceeding from that, I have like link fields in my notes. So I'll link it to those. I have like a gallery system for my notes in Notion. So it all kind of works out at the end of the day. And then what I do is if I'm finished with the book, I'll go into my index note again and I'll link all the links that I've, like all the notes that I've taken from that book or from that YouTube video or whatever. So it's sort of like structured. So I have like kind of a mini book essentially. If I go into the index notes, I'm like, okay, here's the most important things from this. And then I can go down this sort of tree of notes and sort of figure out what I need to know. Or, I mean, Notion has a really decent search now. The search used to be terrible before, but now it's pretty good. So if I need like specific information about something, I'll just search in the search and it gives me the exact note.
Oh, cool. So it really is like serving as like a replacement for Evernote then.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's interesting. So you've got one giant gallery for all your notes, and then you keep an index card with a summary of all the most important notes for each book. And then do you treat books and articles and YouTube videos, movies, whatever, all the same kind of, it just all goes into the box, right?
Yeah. I treat them all the same. And then if something's not interesting anymore, like if I'm reading a book and it kind of just is not helpful anymore, like for example, like you've heard of Nicholas Nassim Taleb. He writes like huge books, right?
Yeah. Like Anti-Fragile and The Black Swan.
That's my favorite one, Anti-Fragile. But his books are, you know, like mini books in one. So you'll read like a certain section of the book, and then after the next section might not be so useful, so you can just drop the book right there. That's kind of what I do.
Cool. I like that.
And with the gallery system I have, I create like little views as well. So I'll have like an index note view, which is just my index notes, and then I'll have a view just for the notes that are entrance notes to certain notes, but not exactly the index note. So it kind of gives me like a tree-like structure. I wish Notion had sort of like a mind map sort of tree sort of view, like Obsidian Rome Research do, which is really cool.
Is that okay? So I've never really used Rome, mostly because I got a free trial to it. I opened it up and it was just a blank page with a single line, and that confused the heck out of me. But the more that I've like started using Notion, the more I've realized like the benefit of just being able to like link arbitrary statements or like whatever between notes, because then I guess you end up like, that's the whole point, right? You're trying to build like a second brain to like store all of the information that you've consumed over the course of your lifetime, I guess, which is, it seems really interesting. I want to accomplish the same thing in a Notion, but yeah, the deep linking thing definitely seems like it's a lot. They've got it now with those like linked pages where you can do the double square brackets or whatever, but I don't think it's the same. At least
it's definitely not the same as Obsidian. Like Obsidian's definitely more powerful, but it's not as user friendly as well, right? I mean, you can write in Markdown, you can get all these like cool features, but like Obsidian with Notion, you with the tables, you have like filtering you can do, you can add like views and that sort of stuff like isn't there or as well designed in Obsidian. Eventually, I think I might move to Obsidian if it ends up becoming more polished. And I believe there is a converter too, like that takes your Notion stuff and puts it into Obsidian, but not too sure about that, if that's still live.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to like even just link the two, like, or like link your different note-taking systems and then just be able to like dump data in through however you want. And then you've got like a different lens to like view it with, I guess. At the end of the day, I guess you could just do that all with one system, which is kind of what Notion is trying to do, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Notion it's good, but it's also not good. Like it's trying to do everything, but it doesn't do everything like 100%, right? Like there's some tools that are just better. Like Obsidian is just like for the deep linking part or Rome Research, right? They're just a lot better, right? And the search used to be terrible on Notion as well, but now it's better, but it's still like other tools are much faster. Like you could sort of have your Zettelkasten in those Emacs org mode, right? And you could use like grep or even grip grep or Zettel F, I believe it's. one of the search tools and have like a better search experience if you wanted to like really find something really deep in your like second brain where you have like 50 billion records.
And so is that the sort of thing you're doing when you're working with Obsidian then? Like if you're using Obsidian, you're also doing the manual stuff on the side as well?
I'm not sure what you mean by like the manual stuff, like the searching bits?
Like searching through command line basically.
I believe it has search functionalities built in, and from what I've heard, they're really good. I haven't worked with Obsidian weight like all that much. Like I tried it out. I'm like, oh, I gotta use Markdown. I'm too lazy for Markdown. I just like want like a pretty UI and like set up a certain flow. Like with my Notion notes, I know exactly like with the index note, like it's already gonna have the index note field checked off for me. I already have like a structure in place, like a certain sort of structure to like put in my data, right? Whereas with Obsidian, it's too freeform. For certain people, like if they want to really have that freedom, it's definitely a powerful tool.
Totally. Yeah. I like that Notion is very structured. Like it gives you the ability to, I don't know, just like maintain like a standard workflow. And you're kind of like, once you've set it up, it's just there. You don't have to think about it anymore. Whereas like when I used to use Evernote, I would come up with my own system and then I'd have to continuously remember, okay, like I put everything related to people under this people category. And then everything related to a business project goes under the specific project, but not if it's a receipt or anything like related to like an archive item, which I then need to put into a different location, which I don't know. To get back to the, so what are you doing now as a developer support engineer? I'm curious what that's like.
So the title's kind of confusing. I mean, it doesn't really explain what I exactly do. So it's, what I do is more like developer advocacy, really. So the company I work for, I'm not going to name them because I don't want to, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to or whatever, but you know, they're a big tech company in the like life sciences space. So we make a lot of like products for drug manufacturers essentially. And we have SDKs and API tooling. So essentially educating the business, the technical consulting teams we have on like what the best SDK for their certain use cases. And, you know, getting them to use like the newer features we use, sort of like advocacy plus education, that sort of work, which is really cool because I get to talk to the customers, or right, like the consulting customer essentially, and I get to understand their pain points, which is really fun.
Yeah. And then so so developer advocacy, so you're talking directly to the customers. So you're not doing sales, like you're working with technical,
like the tech consulting folks? Yeah. I work with them. I'm on technically on the PM team, right? So I work with a lot of the PMs when they're developing the features, understand what the feature does. And when we do a release, I have to do like webinars on the release and educate the folks like, okay, for this certain release, here's the cool features we came out with. Here's why it's important for your certain certain use case or certain regulatory use case or certain pharma life sciences use case or how this makes your life essentially a lot better. And also work on like the API libraries and toolings, like logging any bugs or writing sample code or demos and all that sort of fun stuff.
And do you enjoy that more than you did hands-on development?
Not sure. You can choose one or the other, right? Because as a developer, I mean, yeah, you're working on problems, but they're technical in nature. But at the end of the day, you're creating value for someone, right? That's kind of the mindset I've always had. You shouldn't really focus on the exact problem you're doing. Like, okay, you're building, say, I don't know, a database searching tool, right? Like you're making a new UI for MongoDB to search, right? A database tool for that. Like say something like DataMine, I believe, or DataGripper, one of the IntelliJ tools, right? Mm. Say you're working on that. You shouldn't really care, in my view, too much about like the exact problem. Like, have to connect to MongoDB. You should care about like what's the user going to do, right? What's the value they gain from what I'm working on, what the problem is, right? And if you think from their point of view, you can, in my opinion, solve the problem a lot better.
And so now you're doing that same thing, but without necessarily, like, I guess at the end of the day, you're still focused on translating that customer need or the user end need to something that someone can build. Like it sounds like you're reporting bugs, you're in a way you're doing customer feedback or analysis, like getting input, like requirements gathering is what I was thinking there.
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes, but not as deep as like the PMs would definitely do. But like if, for example, if a customer logs an issue that they're having in a in our developer forums, or one of the consulting team members emails me or messages me over or Google chat or whatever with a problem they're having, and we don't have a solution right now, I go to the PMs, I'm like, hey, do we have a solution for this? Or I check in one of our project management tools, like, oh, do we have a feature coming out for this in release? No? Okay. How do we make the experience better? I go talk to the PMs and try to resolve that, which is really fun in my opinion.
What are some of the bigger differences that you've noticed? Like, how has the role changed, and how is it, like, did it surprise you in any ways that it's similar?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot different from like a total engineering role, right? Here I'm talking a lot more to the end user or to the technical user and learning their pain points and doing a lot more presentations. It's a lot more of an extroverted sort of role. And I'm a developer, so I'm by nature sort of like introverted, working on my computer, like tech problem. So it's really different from that. And you kind of have to stop thinking in the engineering mindset of like, how do I solve this problem? Is it like, you kind of have to transition to like, is this a good problem to solve? And how do I best solve this problem for the end user? Not like just make the solution workable, but like, is this going to have the best experience for the user, right?
It's funny. I always thought that's always, in my mind, that's always been the job of like, at least for a team lead or something like that. But for most software engineers, like if you're not really focusing on the customer need or like the end result, I feel like you're, there's something wrong there.
I agree with that. Like every engineer has to focus on like a customer need, but like, if you're just starting out, you know, you're super far away from the real problem. You're given like a task to do, like, oh, make this feature, right? And you only care about the technical implementation. You don't even care about architecture. If you're really like junior, it's an internship, right? Or it's your first job, you might not care about architecture, right? Whereas if you get to like a little bit higher up on the engineering chain, you're like thinking about architecture, thinking about, okay, is this the best way to solve that problem? You're not really thinking about implementation details to like the nth degree, right?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. There's like an evolution of like where your focus is, right? You start off a bit more low level, like focused on like the details, implementation focus, and then you gradually move higher and higher picture. And then there's the other side of things where there's real life customers and you need to get those requirements from someone. And that's kind of where product comes in more.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Team. I mean, even if you stick to the engineering route, if you get higher up, right, if you're a senior engineer, if you're a team lead, you're still exposed to the same sorts of problems, right? The same sorts of product problems. You're not thinking at the end of the day, like engineering only problems.
Definitely. Yeah. Is there anything you're following or particularly interested in the industry lately that you've seen maybe on Twitter or whatever?
Yeah. So I believe there's that React server-side components demo that goes released. That seems pretty cool in terms of like technology. I'm also working on like side projects and whatnot. So kind of have my handful with like trying to learn new things, like reading habit books and productivity books and whatnot, and do side projects and freelancing and all this sorts of stuff. So I think nowadays I'm less like inclined to like hop on the technology hype train as I was maybe like a year ago or maybe even 2 years ago, where I was like, oh, this new technology came out, I should go and learn it and read it. And it kind of gets stale, right? Because you're like learning this, learning this, learning this. You're kind of always stuck in that beginner level. And you kind of just have to go deep into one thing and be like, okay, I know this and I'm good at this. Let me go really deep into it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's the other way where you can focus on like an industry or a specific like niche. So for instance, developer productivity is one that I've become pretty interested in the last few years, where there's like new tooling coming out, but at the end of the day, it's all solving the same problems as before.
Yeah.
But it's just doing it a bit better. And so it's like, all right, how can you either upgrade an existing toolkit? So like, let's say you're using, like in the example of like WebDriver or something like that, where you're using like end-to-end testing, like how can you take that and then move it over to like, say, Test Cafe or Cypress or something? Or do you need to? Because if you can improve like the productivity of engineers, then you can, like, it doesn't matter what stack you're using as long as you can come up with a good strategy get things built faster.
I think in that sense, like keeping on top of like the new trends is still important. But if you're focused on like developer productivity in your case, you already know what the problems are, right? Like you're for example, Tom always talks about like how onboarding people is a big pain point, right? Like when you're onboarding a new engineer, you've got to set up all their like favorite IDEs and favorite shell configuration or whatever, and then the tech stack has to be set up specifically on their machine, like the databases and all that. So if there's like a new tool that like improves that by like 10%, that's still a good improvement.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if you can, yeah. I mean, if you can onboard people faster, or if you can get anything done faster, then it makes everything easier, I guess. It makes hiring easier too.
Oh yeah.
Which is nice. Okay. I'm just going to wrap it up because we're getting towards time. So if you had a student graduating university and they were like planning on getting into the industry, like do you have any advice or recommendations that you'd give them to do to find their first job or to make the most of it? Sounds like you got quite a good experience in your first few roles that really taught you quite a bit. So be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
I guess if they're just like looking for their first job, it doesn't matter too much where you end up, because I know everyone tries to like go for the Googles, the Amazons, the Facebooks. You know, they don't really look at, say, the smaller companies, the startups and whatnot. But I believe like all experience is valuable in some way. Like if you're at a startup or a big company, you're going to have different experience. But at the end of the day, as long as you're learning, right, that's what's important. So you got to find a place that where you can learn. And to like get to that first job, you kind of have to have either experience from like internships or co-ops or whatever, or side projects, or just, you know, get lucky. I mean, luck is a big factor, I believe, in this industry, right? Like I got lucky with getting my first role where I was working with my friend and learned a lot there and leveraging that. And also, like, I believe when you're like looking for a role, you kind of have to present yourself in the best light. So a lot of people have like imposter syndrome, talking about what they've worked on, what they've achieved, right? But you kind of have to work through that problem and kind of be like, okay, I did this, right? Like I actually built this thing out. And you have to take ownership of what you've built. Because once you take that ownership, that accountability, right, people trust you more. They're like, okay, this person has built this. I can hire them to build this next thing. So sort of working through that imposter syndrome, and that, you know, if you have the experience and you have the side projects under your belt, that really helps. So get either an internship or a side project before you graduate. But if you don't have those, you know, just take any job, honestly, as long as it's going to pay okay-ish and you get to learn a lot, right? So I think the big thing is learning a lot. So kind of have to decide, like, what am I interested in? Personally, for me, when I was in university, I was like, okay, I don't really care too much about, like, the deep technical things. Like, I don't want to go learn how to make compilers, right? For some folks, that's really interesting. Go, you know, work at a research laboratory or something, or go do do a master's. That's your route. But if you're someone like me that's really more so product driven, that's like I want to solve real world problems for real end users, go work at a startup where you're going to be deep in the trenches, right? Go work at a company where you're going to be closer to the end user and get that experience. And that differs for everyone, but yeah, just get the experience, honestly. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's really good advice.
No, that's great advice. I think like there's a big difference between not having had any professional experience and having had even a few months or a year of professional experience, because it just makes the difference, the world of difference, because there's so much you learn in the first few months, like something you brought up earlier about bringing down prod. It's like, there's a huge difference between working on something that's, you know, out there and already working, and also working with a team versus like just building a side project. But once you get that first job, the world's your oyster and things start opening up. So I really appreciate that advice, because yeah, I think it's so important. And the imposter syndrome thing makes a lot of sense, because I mean, especially if someone's applying for their first job, they're not going to, they might not believe that they can do it, but like they should just assume that, you know, if you're going to get the job, you know, you can do it. Don't lie, but, you know, be confident in what you are saying. That's truthful, you know, be comfortable getting out there. And then your point about learning was really great as well, because you're going to want to grow. Like your first role doesn't need to be some career maker.
Yeah.
But definitely, it's a good opportunity to gain a lot of experience and then have something to say at your next role. So like if you're worried about whether or not you're good enough or you can present well enough or whatever, getting any sort of experience is going to give you that confidence to show your true colors.
Yeah, definitely. Like, as you mentioned, like, don't lie, but also don't, like, you know, be so shy that you're like, oh, I worked on this, but like, just always framing it as a team thing. Even if you did all the work or most of the work, right? You kind of have to have that accountability with yourself and ownership and be like, yes, I did do this thing and I'm going to present it as my thing because I did do that, right? So imposter syndrome is big.
Like, I do think that there's, at least for a lot of people, like, there's a lot of merit in owning that a team, like if you did something with a team, you know, don't pretend that you did everything because people can see through bullshit most of the time. Like, don't like lie, you know, but if you did do a good portion of the work, or even if you contributed, don't like say that, you know, oh, the team did this, you know, like you're saying, like present what you did as what you did. Don't undersell yourself, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, going back to that like growth point, for me, when I got my first full-time job out of school, I think in the first 3-4 months, I learned more than I probably did in like a whole year of university, because university, they teach you like the basics. They teach you how to be a computer scientist. They don't like teach you more hands-on, like, okay, what's the best practices for like testing? What should you do in this certain scenario? Like, how do I follow the best practices for certain React scenario or whatever? How do I render my lists in an optimal way? So I think that growth thing is like, it's the biggest thing in my opinion.
Totally. Cool. Well, thanks for doing this, Sam. It's been great.